Hello and good morning to Studies Through the Bible with Pastor Zach Ebar. I am Pastor Zach, and we've had some major technical difficulties this morning, but finally we are able to record this for the fourth time now today. We are going to be looking today at a very important time period in the Bible that's actually not in the Bible. And what I am talking about and referring to, as you all know, is that we ended the Old Testament last week, so therefore the thoughts would be that we moved into the New Testament this week, but actually, we are going to be looking at the 400 years of silence between the Old Testament and the New Testament. This is a very important knowledge to have. I know that, hopefully, unless we can't get it all done in this episode, we will be moving back to next week, going through each book of the Bible, looking at the New Testament. But it's very important that you know about the history and what occurs between the Old Testament and the New Testament and that 400 years of silence from God, where we're not hearing from any prophets, the Messiah is not here, we don't have anybody doing or being led by God in any great way. God has closed the book, per se, on the Old Testament and is preparing the world for the writing of the new one. And the reason it's so important that you know what happens between these two testaments of the Bible is so that you understand the culture and the history and what happened and why it is that this was going on here and now all of a sudden we've got all this going on here. And it's very important to help you understand who the Pharisees, the Sadducees are, understand where these synagogues come from, to understand, why all of a sudden Rome is over Israel and what all happened, how did this occur? And you probably, thankfully, if you're from the United States and listening to this, you probably know a lot more about this 400 years of silence than you realize. This is during the time period of the rising of Alexander the Great and the Greek Empire and Julius Caesar and the rise of the Roman Empire and all of these things. You probably, because this is, we're going to be talking about Western civilizations, and as you know, Rome, Greece, all of these have impacted and affected even the culture of the United States and how we do things and how our governments work and this kind of thing. You probably know a very good deal about Western civilization. You just didn't realize how much of it connected to the Bible itself and how much of it was actually God laying out the groundwork and building the way for the Messiah to come that was promised to Israel. And so let's talk about the end of the Old Testament, okay? We know that at the end of the writings of Malachi, the priesthood of Aaron, while it is, I guess I'm getting tired of recording this. we know that by the end of the writings of Malachi, the priesthood of Aaron, it can still be traced. Aaron's lineage in the priesthood can still be traced all the way back to Aaron. The water is not muddied yet, even though we know that the priesthood is not at all what it should be. Hence the impending doom that is prophesied by Malachi in the book of Malachi. We do know at least that the line of Aaron could still be traced and that the line of David could still be traced all the way back to, David and Aaron themselves. However, the priesthood and the line of David had begun to fall into evil circumstances. And what I mean by that is that it had begun to disintegrate. There had been a lot of bad kings in the line of David. And this led to the Babylonian captivity and then, of course, the Persian-Mede Empire taking over, or the Medo-Persian captivity as well. And actually, by the time all of this happened, Zerubbabel technically could have taken his seat as king, but they were in captivity. And Zerubbabel, we know, was a good guy. We saw Zerubbabel from one of the groups that led the Israelites back to build the temple, to take care of business under God. But it just never comes to be. They're under the influence of the Persian Mede Empire, and he is not allowed to take his seat as king. And So we see this government of Israel is completely disintegrated, okay? The leadership is nothing at all. It's not doing anything whatsoever. It's just gone. But despite the fact that we are in these kinds of situations, the people are still very united. They're still united under the Old Testament law. They're still united under Leviticus. They still can identify themselves as the children of God, the way God had designed for them to work and interact and go about His work. However, by the time we get to the New Testament, it's an entirely different world. All right, the New Testament people are extremely divided. And the reasons for this is we have Roman power, so we have the influence of Western civilization, also referred to as Hellenism, which is a fancy way of saying Greek influence. Okay, we have Herod the Great, who is a figurehead ruling in Jerusalem as king, and he's not even an actual Israelite, which makes the people all the more angry. The line of Aaron is no longer running the temple. The Sanhedrin has now come to power. Those are the Pharisees and the Sadducees, okay? And or Sanhedrin, if you're one of those people, wants to get all crazy about pronunciation. We no longer have Aaron's line running the temple, but rather this group of governing elders, for lack of a better way, who are running it, and the Sadducees are actually holding the position of high priest because the Romans like the Sadducees, because the Sadducees like the Romans, because they make their pocketbook very big, okay? And then we have this other group of almost monastic-type people, monk-like people, known as the Essenes, or the Dead Sea Scroll people, all right? And they lived in caves by the Dead Sea, and they constantly copied the scriptures, okay? And they were very disciplined people. So we have all of these divisions. You got this group of Essenes who teach their doctrine. You have the Pharisees who teach their doctrine. The Sadducees who teach their doctrine. You have idolatry and Western civilization's influence coming in the form of Greece and Rome. You have this king who is completely awful human being. He is not a true Israelite. He doesn't care about the Word of God. And all of this leads to the center of Jewish culture becoming the synagogues. The temple, while they still, some, not all, but some still celebrated the feast. We have kind of this, the temple is just, oh, it's there. That's our beautiful building in the middle of town. And these synagogues begin to pop up because of all the captivity that the Jewish people have been under. This has become their common way of carrying out Levitical law, even though that's not at all what Levitical law calls for. And so we have to ask ourselves, how does this happen? If you're a true student of the Bible, between from Malachi to Matthew, you can see there is a huge difference in the Israelite nation. And the only way we can figure out what it is that shifted this culture, what it is that changed so much about who they are and influenced so much of their traditions and beliefs, we have to talk about what happened in that 400 years of silence. And what happens is that the power of the world, okay? And when I say the power of the world, I mean the people holding all the cards, okay? Begins to shift from Eastern society to Western society. For the first time in history, we are going to have great empires who rule the known world coming out of the West instead of in the East, where they have been up until this point. Most empires, we start Mesopotamia, that's East. Egypt, that's East. Palestine under David and Solomon, that's East. Persia, Babylon, all of these civilizations, they all come out of the Eastern Hemisphere of the world. But for the first time, the West is about to take ownership of the East. And so around 435 BC, Malachi finishes writing his book, okay? He finishes preaching his message. This is the end of God speaking for 400 years. And during this time, we have that shift of power to the West. And we begin this shift of power with the Medo-Persian Empire. That's Daniel chapter 7, verse 5. Where they are prophesied that they are going to fall, okay? And we're slowly moving west with Persia some more. And then we're going to get to this little itty-bitty country known as Macedonia, okay? Macedonia is technically part of the Greek continent, the Greek peninsula, okay? They are west of Thrace, which was controlled and owned by the Persians because the Persians wanted to take over Greece and they could just never pull it off. They tried and they tried and they tried and they failed and failed and failed, okay? But because of this constant raging warfare between Persia and the Greeks, we have this big, huge hatred for Persia if we are Greek people, okay? And what happens is we have this guy named Philip of Macedon who rises to power, okay? And Philip of Macedon, he is a terrible human being, okay? I'm not even going to pull any punches. He's involved in all kinds of idolatry, fornication, murder, scandals. He liked to beat his wives. He's just a terrible, awful human being. And to give you an idea of how the Greeks felt about the Macedonians are essentially the rednecks of the Greeks, okay? If you were a Greek and you met somebody from Macedonia, you'd be like, oh, that's the bad side of town that you're talking about, right? Okay, they are essentially white trash, for lack of a better way of putting it, okay? And I'm not saying this because these are terms I normally use or refer to people as. I just want to give you the idea of how the Greeks looked at this group of people, even though they're basically one and the same. And Philip of Macedon throws the world a curveball, and he ends up uniting the Greek islands. He takes back Thrace. He takes back Triballia. He takes back Dardania. He takes back Illyria. He makes allies with Epirus. He takes back Greece as a whole, Thessaly, Thermopylae, Chaeronea, Thebes, Athens. The only place he doesn't take over in the Greek islands is Sparta, which we all know Sparta was a warrior nation. That would have been a tough cookie to crack. But despite all of this, he takes over everything that is south of him and east of him, okay? And he ends up being the father of Alexander the Great. Now, according to Alexander the Great's mother, he is not the father of Alexander. That Alexander's father is Zeus. He becomes, known as the son of thunder, all right? The son of lightning, this kind of thing. Is one of Alexander's nicknames, okay? But in all reality, he is the father of Alexander the Great. And Philip has this dream of conquering Persia, but he's just too dumb to do it. Okay, it's really what it boils down to. He's not a good military tactician. He relies heavily on just destructive force, overwhelming numbers, okay? And when you're Macedon, yeah, you can have overwhelming numbers with the Greeks because it's a small little peninsula. There's not a lot of people, okay? But when you're fighting a world empire, you cannot just meat grinder that fight. And unlike his father, Alexander the Great is a brilliant tactician. No matter what, I'm going to tell you right now, Alexander the Great, like his father, is a terrible man. Idolatry, sex stuff, all kinds of just crazy immorality going on in the life of Alexander the Great. He's very arrogant. He's very proud. But regardless of all of these things, he is Daniel's goat, okay? The visions of Daniel about the goat and the leopard, that is Alexander the Great. God is going to use this man to help pave the way for the Messiah, regardless of all of these things. And what's amazing about it is that you know God's hand is in it because Alexander the Great, to this day, okay, to this very day, right now, is considered to be one of the greatest leaders and generals the secular world has ever seen. Now, if you're listening to this, you disagree with me, whatever. I don't care, okay? That's what everybody else's consensus is. I'm just feeding you that information. And his military tactics are still studied in military schools today. Up in Baltimore, at the Naval Academy, West Point, all of these places, guys, they still study the tacticians and the movements of men that Alexander the Great did. He was a brilliant general, and not only was he a brilliant general, he became one of the best generals and the basically the ruler of the world in his 20s. In 330 BC, Alexander leads a crushing defeat against Persia. Okay? He wins a battle that he should not have won, and he won it strictly off of luck alone. Well, I say luck alone. God allowing him to win it, obviously. But he does a very ruthless thing. He tells his infantry to move inward into the middle and to hold that line until him and his cavalry can get behind the Persians and create a two-front war. And he barely pulls it off. He loses a ton of men, but for the first time in history fighting the Persians, they have to tuck tail and run. And this is the pivotal moment in which the power of the world finally lands in the West. And Alexander the Great accomplishes this at only 20 years old. And from there, within 1 year after leading this battle against the Persians, he finishes crushing the Persians. He takes over Syria, Palestine, and Egypt. And what's a very interesting story, just to kind of give you some idea of what's going on, he sieges the city of Jerusalem, but he ends up sparing it because Jeddua, who is actually mentioned in Nehemiah, by the way, realizes that Alexander the Great is the guy that Daniel was talking about in his visions. He realizes that he's the goat and that he is the leopard, and he asks for a meeting with Alexander and tells Alexander, look, this is who you are. It was prophesied that you were going to, that you're this guy. And I told you, Alexander the Great's a very arrogant man. And so when he finds out that he was prophesied about in their religious texts, he spares the city and moves on. And this event was actually recorded by Josephus. But one of the other amazing things about Alexander the Great is that he liked other cultures. He liked getting to take Greece to the world, but he liked being able to take Greece and mingle it with all of these other peoples. He did not try to destroy religions. He did not try to destroy cultural monuments. He wanted the culture to remain intact and for them to bring what they had that was best to the table of the Greek Empire. He wanted these other nations' best ideas to become Greece's best ideas. And so he comes in and people love him. There's a lot of people who willingly surrender to Alexander the Great just to become a part of the empire. And he sweeps through the world very quickly. By the time he's 27 years old, he's conquered all there is to conquer. He's taken over parts of India. He's taken over the Persian Empire. He's taken over Egypt. He's taken over Palestine. He's taken over the Arabian Peninsula. He's taken over everything in the known world at this time. And his lifestyle, though, of drinking and fighting, his war wounds, his fornication, he just lived a very rough, wild lifestyle. eventually catches up with him, and he dies at 27 years old in 323 BC. Okay? Now, Alexander the Great is somebody who loves nothing more than strength and brutality, cleverness. He is essentially the kind of guy that liked tough men, okay? And as he is on his deathbed, he does something the world has never seen yet again. And he calls his generals in, his four main generals, and they ask him who's going to be the heir. Everybody knows he's going to die. Some people believe he was poisoned. Doesn't matter. Either way, he dies in this time period. And he looks at his generals and he says, "To the victor goes the spoils." And he dies. Meaning that Alexander the Great, despite having some children that could be the heir to the throne back home in Macedon, tells his four generals, whichever of you is toughest enough to conquer the other three is the one who deserves my empire. And it is because of this that the Greek Empire begins to crumble, and it is divided four ways. Obviously, we know that by the time Jesus comes on the scene, who's in leading power? Rome. So this is all part of God's plan, guys. God creates this young man. He knows what kind of general he's going to be. He allows him all his victory so that he can connect the known world, which is what was needed for the gospel to spread the way it did. Because everything was under Roman power, the apostles were able to move freely from place to place to place to place to place, preaching and teaching the gospel, and Jesus Christ as well. It was very pivotal that this occurred. God didn't just let all this happen and build this setup for nothing. It was all in relation to the redemptive plan that God had in store for mankind. And so the empire is divided technically five ways, okay? Lysimachus, his son, is ruling over in Macedon. However, Cassander and Lysimachus, they basically fall away, and before you know it, we only have Ptolemy, Antigonus, and Seleucus left on the table, and then it's not long after that that Seleucus and Ptolemy are the only two left, okay? And so what happens is that Palestine, because of this four-way division, is basically becomes the meat grinder, all right? It falls under control of Ptolemy, and the prophecies in Daniel 11 come to fruition under Ptolemy. This time period gives rise to the Hellenistic culture of Christ's time, meaning the Greek influence of Christ's time. You know, there's Hellenistic Jews, you'll see that in the New Testament, and then there's Orthodox Jews, and you'll see that. And this is also where the Pharisees, who are separatists, and the Sadducees, who are call themselves rationalists, are created. These two groups, the Sadducees kind of embrace this Hellenism, this coming of Greek civilization because it pads their pocketbooks really good. However, the Pharisees are completely and totally against it. And so you have basically these two political parties really that form. They consider themselves to be religious groups, but for all intents and purposes, they're political. And so Ptolemy comes in, he takes this over, and there is constant war going on, okay? Constant fighting back and forth and back and forth between Ptolemy and Seleucid and Ptolemy and Seleucid. People are dying left and right. Israel doesn't know who owns them one day from the next. And they, you know, some of course obviously begin, you know, longer, you know, lie with the dogs, come up with fleas. The longer they're around these two Gentile groups, they become more like them. Now, I have a side note, because it's during this time also that we discover why the Jews really hate the Samaritans in Jesus Christ's time. Do you remember the woman at the well when Jesus came to her and she said, "Why is it that you, a Jewish man, speak to me, a Samaritan woman?" Okay? Obviously, all right? Obviously, part of this is due to the fact that they are a half-breed, okay? They have a half-breed lineage. They are part Assyrian, part this, part that, part everything, and part Jew. They're not full-blood Jewish people, okay? The United States, we're all half-breeds. We're all mutts for the most part. There's not very many true Italians, true this, true Native Americans, true any of that. For the most part, we're all a big, huge conglomerate of a Heinz 57, okay? However, there was one young priest who decided to marry a Samaritan woman, and he is responsible for the building of the rival temple on Mount Gerizim. The biggest problem they have is this young priest builds this temple, and essentially the Samaritans try to form their own Jerusalem, for lack of a better way of putting it. They have a huge problem with them because of their lineage, but they have an even bigger problem with them because of their false teaching, of the fact that they build this temple and this priest marries this Samaritan woman. There's just a lot of hatred here because it's kind of like they're copycatting the Jews, and they already didn't like them to begin with, and they really didn't like them all the more once they had their temple. And you also remember the woman at the well said, well, you have your temple in Jerusalem and we have our temple on the mount, okay? That's what she's talking about, is that, well, we worship the same God. And the Jews are like, no, you do not. You're not doing that. They insist, yes, we do. Kind of like modern Christians and Islam back and forth and Jews back and forth. Like, no, we worship, no, we don't. Yes, we do. No, we don't. Yes, we do. Yeah, back and forth. And so this also happens during this time period where this hatred for the Samaritans forms because of this building of a rival temple that pulls away a lot of people, in fact, from the one in Jerusalem. But let's talk for a minute about the pros of Ptolemy's rule, okay? Some good things about the rule of Ptolemy. Hebrew scripture was being translated in 284 BC from Hebrew to Greek for the first time. Excuse me, goodness gracious. For the first time in all of Jewish history, the scriptures are being translated into another language. It is because of things like this you and I have an English Bible today. I am sorry if you are somebody that advocates King James only, or somebody who advocates ESV only, or somebody who advocates New American Standard only. I am here to crush your heart. The original form of the Bible is the Hebrew and Greek scriptures in which it was written. Other than that, we all have a translation of the original scriptures. So there is no need for you to harp on which one's better or which one's right or which one's not right, because at the end of the day, they are all translations of the actual original scriptures. And that starts here, friend. I don't know Hebrew. Hold on. Back to train up. I know Hebrew and I know Greek from seminary, okay? I do not speak Hebrew and Greek, okay? That's what I'm getting at. If it was not for sitting down and learning how to read this on paper and knowing what all these words are and how they interact with each other, I could not read the scriptures if they were still in Hebrew. The same way you could not. This is the beginning of God opening the word of God to the world. And it starts in 284 BC, 280 years before Jesus Christ is born, God is making his word available to the Gentiles. And it is known as, and you probably know this name, the Septuagint, because 70 scholars worked on the translation. Septa meaning 70, okay? Now, there are some dark days for Palestine, okay? Antiochus the Great and Antiochus Epiphanes, or Epipananes, which was what they made fun of him as. We'll talk about that in a second. But in 203 BC, Antiochus the Great captures control of Jerusalem from the Ptolemy Empire. Okay? Now, Antiochus the Great, his sons all died, and he himself also which ends up leading to his brother Antiochus Epiphanes taking the throne. But he comes in and he takes over completely, removes Ptolemy from power and takes all of this over. And something you need to know about apparently I cannot say my names today. What you need to know is that while Antiochus the Great wasn't, he wasn't a good man, but he wasn't technically a terrible man. His brother, Antiochus Epiphanes, is recalled the Old Testament Antichrist. He is one of the most vile and evil men in history. He refers to himself as the Illustrious. That's the Epiphanes part. Antiochus the Illustrious, okay? But he received a nickname from the people, which was called Antiochus Epiphanes, which means madman. He was a violent persecutor of the Hebrews. He loved to kill people. He was essentially crazy. He gave himself nicknames. He expected to be worshipped like a god. And he goes in very quickly and makes a ton of changes to the Israelites' way of doing things. The first thing he does is he disposes of the high priest, which ends the line of Aaron as the high priest in Israel. This happens in 200 BC, okay, 284. He sells the priesthood to Jason, who then lost it deceitfully to Menelaus, which are Hebrew guys who wanted to be in political power, wanted the priesthood, these kinds of things. And Jason ends up losing it to Menelaus, I believe, in a gambling debt. And what happens from there is that all religious aspects of Jerusalem begin to deteriorate. They weren't great before, but after this, they truly begin to fall apart at a rapid pace. And then, shortly after all of this, in 171 BC, okay, Antiochus invades Egypt, all right? And like I said, he is hated. Extremely hated by the Israelites. He's not a good man. He has come in and ruined their people. He's come in and taken away their priesthood. He has turned the whole world upside down for them, okay? And he decides that from Israel, he wants to take over and invade Egypt. And while he is in Egypt, it is falsely reported that he died in battle. Okay, I don't know who crossed the wires or what, but they go throughout the empire reporting that Antiochus Epiphanes, or Epipomanes as they called him, has died. Okay? And Israel rejoices and overthrows Menelaus to restore their kingdom, and they basically have a big, huge luau for a very long time. And, of course, Antiochus is not actually dead. And he receives news of what happened, of the people rejoicing, throwing Menelaus out, and restoring their city back to what it's supposed to be. And he comes back home angry and looking for blood. And he comes into Jerusalem and he kills 40,000 Israelites. And he desolates the temple, which was prophesied to happen in Daniel 8:14. He slaughters a pig on the altar, spreads blood all around the temple, and defiles it, and begins to do a lot of harsh, harsh, critical things, even worse than what he was already doing before, to the people. And this leads to the rise of the Maccabees. If any of you have heard of the Apocrypha, you know of the first and second book of Maccabees, okay? And Maccabee is a family name, okay? It's the name of a particular group of Israelite men. And the one in particular that we need to focus on is Judas Maccabeus. Along with his brothers and his father, they lead an uprising, okay? They decide that they are done with Antiochus, they're done with the Ptolemies, they're done with the Seleucids, they're done with the Romans, who they're done with the Romans, who is where Antiochus and the Great and Antiochus Epiphanes are from, and they actually win. They start this revolt. There is a guy who comes into the city and says that they have to worship Antiochus from now on. They cannot worship in the temple. And Judas Maccabeus' father kills the guy who has come into town, and that starts the war. They hide out in the hills. People slowly join the rebellion, and they conduct guerrilla warfare against Rome. And they win, and they cleanse the temple, finally, 6.5 years after its desolation by Antiochus Epiphanes. And so what happens is that the Hebrews, under the Asmonean dynasty, which is the Maccabeans, they enjoy 100 years of independence and make a deal with Rome. And this actually establishes the Feast of the Dedication, or Hanukkah, as you know it. Now, as we all know, all good things must come to an end. And throughout that 100 years of independence with Israel, they were constantly being attacked. And finally, Pompey, as y'all all know, another great general for the Romans, he is motivated by money, and he's basically told, hey, we're going to pay you this if you can take back Jerusalem. And in 63 BC, he enters Jerusalem, and he slaughters people and takes back Jerusalem. And now Jerusalem will remain under Roman control until Antipater puts Herod the Great on the throne in 37 BC. So, between the Testaments, this is what happens. Greece, to kind of give you a summary of everything we've talked about, Greece comes in under Alexander the Great. They take back Jerusalem under Alexander the Great. And then very quickly, we see Rome come to power. Rome takes over Jerusalem from Ptolemy, and because, you know, we know that Ptolemy and Seleucid kind of shuffled that one back and forth a few times. And after they take it back over, we have the Maccabean Revolt that initiates Hanukkah. And very shortly after that, Rome, 100 years later, takes it all back, and it will remain under Roman control until Herod the Great is put on the throne by Antipater in 37 BC. So that is a very quick, very high points discussion of what happens between the Old Testament, New Testament, and we will definitely talk more in detail as we are going through the books of the Bible and the New Testament about a lot of these events, because a lot of these events are actually discussed in the New Testament, and there's a lot of events that are going to happen much later during the time period of Acts and the Apostles that Jesus Christ said would come to pass that greatly affect the Israelite culture. But so, that has been Studies Through the Bible, aka the Intertestamental Period. I hope you guys have enjoyed it. Get out of here and go study.